You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
Frida K. Heitzman. I was born on January 21st, 1943, and we were in San Diego, California.
Rita Euler is a compassionate, caring, and Christ-like woman. She's dedicated her life to helping those in need through her incredible nursing career and as a missionary. Her greatest role, however, has been as wife and mother to her husband of 60 years and her seven amazing children. She was raised as a horse-riding cheerleader in rural Idaho. She attended Weber College, where she met Dick, who introduced her to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Since then, her focus has been on her family and the Lord as she's worked as a labor and delivery nurse at night, raised her kids, served four faithful missions, and consistently worked in the temple, which she still does today. Her story begins with her parents.
Edward Heitzman and Marguerite Lydia Moss Heitzman. Mom was raised in McCammon. My father was raised in Emerson, Nebraska. When he was about 17 or 18, he decided to go west, and of course no one had any money, so he went down to the railroad and after dark hopped onto a rail that was headed west and literally rode on the bars underneath the car above the track until he got out of town far enough that no one was looking for people like him. They stopped someplace. And at that time, he moved himself to the top of the car. Across the top, they have two big bars that go right down the full length of the car. And my dad laid down between those two bars, grabbed hold, and went to sleep, and rode his way to Jerome, Idaho. My dad could sleep anytime, any place, and he rode the train until he got to Idaho. Got off, and there found a job and worked for a while, and then he went on over to Washington and did the same kind of work over there, but came back to Jerome, and that's where he and Mom met. My mother was in Jerome living with her older sister and helping her out on the farm, and her husband hired my dad to work on the farm. So Mom's working there helping her sister, and my dad-to-be was working in the farm helping her husband. So they got acquainted, and that's where it all started. Well, it was wartime, and my parents had gone down there to San Diego to live. They were newlyweds, and there wasn't much work up in Jerome. My dad had taken 100-pound sacks of potatoes to California to sell them. As soon as they saw how good those Idaho russets were, they called him right back and said, "I'll take as many as you can get to me." And Dad said, "Yes, I can provide them." Hung up and said to Mom, "I have no idea where I'm going to get those from." So that's when he started going to the farmers in Jerome. My dad had a 10th grade education is all. He walked out of a Catholic school when the sisters slapped him on the hands for using his left hand. And he'd had enough of it one day, and he just walked out and never went back. So my dad only had a 10th grade education. So they were in San Diego trying to sell two sacks of potatoes. But while he was down there, he also got a job working in an airplane factory, sweeping the floor. And within a month, he was made foreman of the factory, and he had 45 women working under him, making airplane parts and preparing things, you know, to ship off to the war. And so he worked there until the day the war was over. And the day the war was over, they hit the road and came back to Idaho. Well, during those 2 years, I was born in San Diego.
Thank you. As an adult, Rita learned some interesting and exciting news about her family.
Up until 1994 or 5, I thought I was the oldest. And I had two younger brothers and a younger sister. And I found out mom and dad, prior to their marriage, had a baby. In those days, that was a big no-no, even more than it is now. They put her up for adoption and never told any of us kids. None of us ever knew because my mom wouldn't let dad tell. She was that set on it. And mom was quite the little spitfire, and she got what she wanted. And it wasn't until she was very, very ill with Alzheimer's and didn't know daddy and didn't know us that he decided it was time that we all knew our older sister. In 1995, we were introduced to an older sister for the first time. And we loved her dearly. We clicked day one, picked up. It was as if we'd known each other forever. We lived on the farm out south of town, and I think we had 88 acres. Daddy raised potatoes, a few cattle, some horses. So we just had a very normal farm life. We had chickens to feed and eggs to gather and cows to milk and dogs and cats and all kinds of animals around us all the time. But it was a very simple life, but a lot of work. Mom and Dad taught us to work hard and play hard. And we always played in the canal. So we swam there, played in the mud. When Dad watered the yard, it was flood irrigated, and so you'd get about 3 or 4 inches of water on the lawn, and he'd let us run in it, and we would just splash and play and do that kind of stuff. We rode horses. We had horses, and I think that's probably where my love of horses came from. We had a horse named Kate, who was an old mare, just an easygoing horse, and my dad used to put us on the back of the horse, and he'd put all four of us on there, no saddle, no bridle, when it was time to bring the cows in from the field to milk. And he'd put us kids on the horse and slap her on the rump, and she'd just start walking down the lane, down to the canal, down into the canal, through it, up the other side. And as soon as we got up on the other side, the cows saw us and knew it was time, and they started coming in to the barn. And we would just get around behind them and follow them back in. We kids thought we were going to get the cows to be milked. Kate was doing it. We just went along for the ride. But that's where I found my love of horses, I think. She was a good old mare, and all of us kids learned to ride on her. So we did a lot of riding. That's a lot of the entertainment we did. We'd get on the horse and ride wherever we wanted to go. I mean, I had a good friend from grade school who lived 6 miles away from me, and we'd phone call. And we'd say, okay, we'll meet halfway, and we'd book it on our horse and ride to meet, and then we'd either go to her house or to my house. Life was simple, very simple in those days. We didn't have to be entertained. We learned to entertain ourselves with simple things. So it was probably the best upbringing you could have.
Growing up in rural Idaho, Rita had some unique experiences in her schooling years.
We went to school, we went to Appleton, which was a little red brick building covered with ivy out in the rural area south of Jerome. Rode a bus to school every day and rode the bus back every day. And that school went from first grade to eighth, and I have lots of fond memories from that school. There were 12 children in my class that stayed in Jerome and actually went from the first grade and graduated from Jerome High together in 1961. We were all farm kids, and we had all kinds of exciting adventures together and crazy stuff that we did that was just fun. At school, we had small classes, and so we really became good friends. And there was a road that went by the school, and there was a little store on the other side of the road. And so during lunch hour, the seventh and eighth graders go to the road, and we had what we call store assignment. And the younger children would bring their pennies and their nickels and their dimes, and they would tell us what they wanted from the store. And then the seventh and eighth graders would go across, make their purchase, and bring it back across the road, because they weren't allowed to go across this one little road. And it probably had a car go by every 10 minutes. Our principal of the school was Mr. Miller, and he taught the eighth grade. And in the eighth grade room, there was a great big fire escape for the whole building. And so we had drills all the time on how we would get everybody out of the building if there was a fire. It became a big attraction for everybody. It was just a big round tube that went out the wall and down the side of the building. And we used to go in and bribe him during recess time to see if we could go down the slide, fire escape. And Mr. Miller had really bushy eyebrows, and he used to run his fingers backwards, and it'd bring his eyebrows, they'd just hang down over his eyes, and he'd look at us with a real mean scowl, and he'd say, "Only if I can't catch you." That was our signal. We'd take off, jump in the fire escape, and go down and be free. We thought it was a big game, but we did it often. It was a lot of fun. And sixth grade, Mr. Taylor, and he must have been just barely out of college. And two or three times during our sixth grade year, we went to school. And when we got into the room, he would say, "Grab your coats and get on the bus. We're going for a ride." He would drive the bus down into the canyon, and we'd go down to Thousand Springs, and he would fish with the boys, and we would climb in the rocks, and we'd pick flowers, and he'd have a lunch made for us, and we'd play there all day long. But just before we would leave, we'd hike up the side of the canyon, and there's caves up in there, and he'd take us back into one of those caves just around the corner where it was pitch black, and he'd tell us a ghost story, scare us to death. We'd start screaming and running out, and that would stir up the bats that were in those caves. And so we'd all come running out, screaming and carrying on like sixth graders would, you know. We'd hop back on the bus, and we'd come back to school, and we'd come home. Nobody knew the difference, but he would just spontaneously do that. When I got into high school, I was in a riding group that square danced on horseback. We had music, we had a collar, we did four squares, so there was 24 of us in that group. We spent the summer going to different rodeos throughout the valley and into Utah, and the biggest one I went to was the Snake River Stampede. We performed there as a specialty act. So that was what our summers were spent doing, was practicing and traveling. My mom was all of 4'11", just a short little thing, and she'd pack up two of us with the horse in the trailer and hook it up to the truck and or the pickup, and we'd take off and go to a rodeo and perform. And Dad would stay home and keep the fires burning. I played basketball. In my days at basketball, though, the girls only played half court. We had six players on a team. So if the guards got the ball away from the forwards on their end, they would take it to the half and pass it to us, and then we would go in and do the shoot. They couldn't go across. So I played basketball, and that was fun. And I was a cheerleader. I started cheerleading out at Appleton, and I cheered through 2 years of college. So for 8 years, I was a cheerleader. And if you were the cheer queen or the head cheerleader, you were in student council. So I spent my high school years in student council every year, and that was fun, having an influence on the whole school. When I was a sophomore, I started dating a young man that was a year older than me. He was a football player, and so I went to all the dances. You go to all the school activities. Then when he graduates, of course, you're a senior, and you don't have your date anymore. And so my senior year, I was very well cared for by all of my friends. We went to drive-in movies. We drug Maine. One weekend, my mom and dad went out of town, and I was in probably a sophomore or junior. And Dad said I could take the car and I could drive, but not to leave town, not to go to Twin. Don't go across the canyon to Twin. Stay home. So we went down, two or three of the girls and I, we'd get in the car and we'd go down, we'd drag Maine. just back and forth. Everybody's doing this, and you're waving and yelling, and I don't know. It was so dumb. I mean, we didn't accomplish anything, but we just drug me. So Mom and Dad come home on Sunday, and I didn't see my dad angry very often, but he was upset with me, and he said, I thought I told you not to leave town. And I said, I didn't. Well, he'd taken the mileage on the car, and I'd put on something like 80 or 90 miles on the car. That's, I mean, how long that is. I think our main street must have been about a mile when you go from one end to the other like we used to do. And I'd put 90 miles on the car. Dad was a very mild-mannered guy. I don't remember my parents ever sitting down and teaching us anything by word. It was always by just their example that we learned. And my dad was just a quiet man. I did not know how much good he had in him until my mom got so sick. He took care of her for 12 years with Alzheimer's. He just did the best job ever. And he'd take her for rides and take her for trips and take care of her until it got to be what we kids thought was too much for him. And we told him we thought he should have Mom put into a place where they could take care of her. And he was totally against it, but finally succumbed to all of us just insisting that he do it. And it lasted about, it must have been about a month. He'd see her every day and spend time with her. And when it was time for him to go home, he says, she looks at me with this look that says, really, you're going to leave me here again? And it just tore up his heart. He just couldn't handle it. So he said, I'm bringing her home. And we said, okay. So my sister and I said, we'll find somebody to help you at home. And Heavenly Father sent us an angel. And then she stayed on and took care of Daddy. Dad was a Catholic, non-practicing. Mom was LDS. And I can't even remember how old I was when I found out that Mother was LDS. I didn't know it because we never went to church. She's totally inactive. We were raised in a good home with good parents and taught honesty and integrity and kindness and helpfulness, all those things that you need to learn in a home. And I can remember as a young person, that good friend of mine I used to ride a horse to meet, she was Presbyterian, and I used to just long to be able to go to church. I had that desire in me just naturally. I didn't even know what it was. I didn't even know what I was desiring, but I wanted to go with her, and Mom would let me go once in a while. And after a couple of three times, she'd say, that's enough. And I liked being there. And so when Dick came along, I think that plugged into what happened between he and I. It's about this time that Dick and I get together
that Mom decides to be somewhat active, and they called her to be a librarian. And from that point on, for about 20 years, she was a librarian at the church. And so it was like our getting together stirred her to remember and to have those feelings that she needed to be back there. Now I'm a member. One of my brothers is a member and a temple worker, and my sister is a member and a temple worker. And Sharon, the older sister that we found, was very active in the LDS church. Before I went to Weber, I went 2 years over here at the C of I here in Caldwell and started went in as pre-med and did my math and science and physics and that kind of stuff. And then I decided it's time to get started on this nursing that I want so bad. And so my mom and I drove to Utah, quit doing the cheerleading, and went to Utah and got serious about school.
That move to Weber State was the start of a 60-year love story.
We met at college at Weber State, and he was home from his mission. And we had a very fast courtship and a short engagement. He saw me across the crowded room. He decided he wanted to get to know me. He got my address, my major, my phone number. So my first encounter with him was when he showed up at I was living with my brother in a trailer house. Dick shows up at the door with this crazy story. He was looking for a health book
And that's what he came after, was a health book. And I didn't have a health book. So long story short, he said, "What are you doing Easter Sunday?" And I said, "Well, I'm here studying." And he said, "Well, how about if we go out for dinner?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going steady." And he said, "Well, I'll be here at 2 o'clock. I'm going steady." And he leaves. 2 o'clock, he's there. 2 o'clock, I'm ready. So we went out to eat and had a date. And that all went well. And he brought me home and he said, "What are you doing Wednesday night?" "Well, let's go to a movie." "I can't. I'm going steady. I'll pick you up at 6 o'clock." That's one thing about Dick. If he decides he wants something, he pretty much makes it happen. That part of him I didn't know about yet. So we went to the movie and we were sitting in the middle section of the movie, and who walks down the aisle but the fellow I'm going steady with another girl. And he doesn't see us, but we see him. And he walks down the aisle and they sit about, probably 5 or 6 rows down in front of us. And so we just stayed and watched the movie. So the next day, I was wearing some ring he'd given me anyway. I went back to where he worked and I gave him his ring back. And I said, "I hope you enjoyed the movie last night." And didn't say any more, turned around and walked out. Never saw him again. And from that point on, we were pretty much linked together.
It was Dick who introduced Rita to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and she's been a faithful member ever since.
So right after we met, I took him home to Jerome to meet Mom and Dad, and they, of course, fell in love with him. On our trip home, and I've never been to an LDS church, he said, "We need to get you baptized." And I said, "Oh, okay," not knowing precisely what all that entailed. And we go back to Jerome, and we talk to the man who would have been Mom's bishop if she were active, and he talked to both of us, did all the paperwork. Dick baptized me that weekend while we were there. So I was baptized with no lessons, no information, no teaching, no. But I was okay with it because Dick said it was the right thing to do, so I said okay. So I learned the gospel by living it. From day one, day after day, just following his example and his teachings. He taught me as we went along. And as we began to have our family, I began to realize that it was indeed what we needed in our lives. And I was totally committed then, even though I probably still didn't totally understand everything. I was totally committed. And so as I lived the gospel principles from day to day, I felt its goodness. I felt its joy. I felt this is right. And so the focus on the family was just what I needed and what I wanted, and it just made everything come together. And you can't focus on your family without focusing on the Lord, in my mind, because they just go together. When you follow the principles, it just brings you joy and happiness. That's all it is.
Before long, the happy couple was engaged.
We went out for a drive or for a date one night, and he says, "Let's go up and see where they're building the track and the football field and the new athletic area." So we drove up there and parked, and he pulls out this ring box and he showed me this ring, this beautiful diamond. And that was his proposal. When it sunk into what was happening, I was all for it. And so when I called Mom and Dad to tell them about that, they said, "Oh, that's wonderful. You know, we're so happy," and just was joyful. And then the next day I was in school, I was going to nurses training in Weber. I was called out of class. In fact, I was taking a test. I was called out of a test class because my parents were on the phone and my mother was just crying so hard. And she said, "We are calling to tell you how happy we are about your engagement. We felt like we did not really let you know that last night." And they had fallen in love with him pretty fast too. So I have always felt like he was just trustworthy, and I sensed it. Well, we only known each other about 6 weeks when we got engaged. We met in March and we were married in August. And our kids, when they heard that story, could not believe that I could do that. And I said, looking back on it, I think I know what's happened. You know, in the Doctrine and Covenants in section 46, where we talk about spiritual gifts that the Lord has given us, one of those spiritual gifts
is a heart that believes on other people's beliefs. Because when I met Dick, tall, dark, handsome man, I mean, what else do you need? But I had this connection with him that I could trust whatever he said. I just felt like I could trust him, and I didn't question. Well, we were married civilly one night in Jerome at the church house. It was sweet. It was simple. We had bridesmaids and best men, our friends and our family, and a little reception afterwards. And then the next morning at 7 o'clock, we were at Idaho Falls to be sealed. And you're saying, how did that happen? We're not quite sure. In fact, we look on it now and we just giggle and we think, I wonder if we're really legally married. But of course we are. Went into the temple at 7 o'clock and we came out at like 3 p.m. I received my endowment and we were sealed. We were there all day. We left the temple, went to a hotel and slept, both of us. It was just, we were exhausted. We went for a time up in the mountains. Somebody in his family had a cabin and we went up and spent 3 or 4 days up there. Had a great time. We've stayed together for all this time. We're 60 years next week.
Throughout those 60 years, Rita realized her dream of being a wife, a mother, and a nurse.
I always wanted to be a nurse and take care of people. That was my desire. I never really worked full time outside the home. I did for a period of time while Dick was in dental school. And when I was working full time while he was in school, that's when we had Dawn, our first child. And it didn't take me very long to know I didn't like evening shifts because that's when he's home and that's when the family's home. And so when I finally got to through those 4 years while Dick was in dental school and we were off on our own, so to speak, I always worked nights. Then I would go after the children were in bed and I'd be home before they'd leave for school. I worked for 27 years in labor and delivery and newborn intensive care and 13 years in dialysis. When we moved to Boise, which was in 1990, I could not get on labor and delivery. I had a friend that was working in dialysis and she said, why don't you come and try this? So I did, and it about killed me. Because I went from pediatrics to geriatrics. And learning those machines was pretty tough on my brain for a while. Labor and delivery was my love. The babies, yes, but more than the babies, the moms. Because I love the connection. You can train them. You can teach them breathe right to help themselves during labor. I just love the connection that we made with new families. And when I first started, dads weren't allowed in the delivery room and eventually got to the point where we was able to teach dad how to help mom. And then when that baby's born, it's a family that bonds, not just a mom and a baby. It makes such a difference.
Rita's nursing career was made possible by a decision the couple made early on.
So he was already accepted to dental school, and I had one more year left. And so in his wisdom, he didn't think it was smart to pull me out of nursing school to go to dental school. So he turned down his acceptance and he worked for a year while I finished my nursing degree. He reapplied to dental school and was reaccepted. So we hit the road and went to Cleveland. It was my first trip out of Idaho, so to speak, other than just family things that we'd done when we were younger. And we got to the big city of Cleveland, Ohio, and boy, what a shocker to this little country girl. Because all the way back, we were listening on the radio to the racial riots that were going on in California. And when we got to Cleveland, they were having racial riots in their area, which happened to be right next to where he was going to dental school and I was working. So we could hear the gunshots, we could see the fires as we were going to school, as we worked. And they brought the military in and they sat down in our hospital parking lot. It's where they set up their center. And so for
The longest time I was literally escorted from my car to the hospital as I would go to work. And then when I was off duty, they'd walk me back to my car because it was just too dangerous to walk by yourself that short distance. And he's going to dental school, and he was working 3 part-time jobs to help pay for school. I mean, we were living on nothing. We were making very little, even though we were working all these jobs. So we drove from school straight to New Mexico to take a look at this new home we were going to have. And Don was 2 years old, and I was sicker than a dog en route and found out that we were pregnant with our second at that time. In Albuquerque, we lived in a trailer house, and that was fun. We had a section that we slid out. When you set it up, you slid it out, and we were living in there. We had 2 bedrooms, that was all. And that was quite the experience with those little ones. Dawn, Kenyon, and Amber. So after we lived in Albuquerque for a couple of years, and he was out of the service then, we opened up a practice in Malad, and we lived there. And then we had Nicole when we left and went to Samoa. He had this opportunity to go over there and teach and upgrade their dental equipment. And so we took it. They treated us very nicely. I mean, we were in a very primitive area, but they had some like housing there that was really housing instead of the follies that the island people live in. So we had a roof and we had walls and we had doors and windows. That sounds funny, but it was challenging because the weather is hot, humid, rains. We had some good times there. We learned to snorkel, and Dick and I had become certified scuba divers when he was in dental school. Well, we got to Samoa. They have beautiful clear water there. So we did a lot of snorkeling, did a little bit of scuba diving. Then we moved to Pocatello, and he had a practice there.
It was in Pocatello that the Oilers welcomed their last 3 kids, Aaron, Chad, and Kimberly.
That was our first home that we owned, and that was exciting. We had 2.5 acres, so we had our horses again. So the kids were all introduced to life with horses and dogs and cats, all the fun things. And they all had a love for horses too. So we had a lot of good times there.
But eventually it was time for the family to move to Boise, where they've stayed ever since.
Dick got an opportunity to come up here and work at the prison as a dentist. I came kicking and screaming. I didn't want to move. I thought we were in a good spot there in Pocatello. But now looking back, it was a good move. We've been here 34 years now, since 1990.
As Rita said, the true focus of her life has been raising her amazing kids.
We talk to our kids about this all the time because now they have big families and they have amazing children. And I say, kids have done so well. And then they'll turn around and say, well, Mom, we learned it from you. And I don't feel like I personally ever really did anything outstanding or amazing or unique. The Lord blessed me with this strong family drive. And make mistakes, I've made tons of them. You have the Lord on your side then, and he makes up the difference. And he had to make up a lot of difference with this one. But I always try to do my best. That's all I can say. Dawn, she's a typical first child, very energetic, spiritually minded, driven to do things well and perfectly. She reaches out to other people so well. She is a giver all the way. She loves life, and everybody that knows her loves her. Kenyon, first boy, he has got a love and a compassion and a tenderness in him that sometimes he forgets to let come out these days. But he's always been a very tender-hearted man. I love that. Having a kindness and a gentleness towards people and animals. He's a great dad. He's just a good, solid man. Amber, the biggest heart in the world. She'll give you anything. She'll do anything for you. She's kind and loving. She gives so much that she overlooks herself sometimes and then finds herself depleted. But she's very giving and very kind and just loves to be around her family too. That's another thing. She loves to have her family around her. Nicole, typical middle child. She's an awesome listener. She's a great counselor. She is an organizer. She can get more done in a day than six people can together. Just reaches out to everybody. She has an almost magnetic pull towards people that are hurting or in need. She senses it, and she always can say to do the right thing. And it's usually behind the scenes. She's a behind-the-scene girl and always does the right thing. Just a sweetheart. Aaron, spiritual giant. He also is driven. He gets focused on something. He can block out anything and everything that's around him, which is a real talent. Great dad, loves to have fun. All of our kids are good athletes, and they all like to have fun. Chad, he is probably, he's the soccer king in our family. He's played college soccer and semi-pro soccer. Great athlete. He also is a spiritual giant. He's just got so much strength inside of him and knowledge. He too will do anything for anybody. A real giver. Endures pain very well. He's climbed Mount Kilimanjaro with a torn ACL. Kimberly, our youngest, just a giver, a goer, an organizer, a heart as big as a mountain. Always remembers the little things, the special dates. I don't think we have a birthday or an anniversary or a Mother's Day or a Father's Day that we don't hear from all seven of them. Our special birthdays, our special anniversary, they always remember. They're just very giving and aware of other people and their special things, their needs, their wants. And we don't feel like we can take credit for it. That's what I'm trying to get to, is that they basically came that way. We just did the best we could at day-to-day stuff. Just keep the clothes clean, make sure the food's on the table, make sure they're all the things they need to be to and want to be to. And we kind of were the glue that held them all together, and they raised themselves almost.
Some of the funny memories Rita shared were some pranks pulled by Dick.
Dawn, one time when she was a teenager and we were living in Pocatello, and she wanted a phone in her room. Well, that was a no-no. But Dick, for Christmas, we bought a plastic toy phone, wrapped it up, and that was her phone. Nicole wanted a car. One of our friends had one, and so Dick, on her birthday, probably her 16th or 17th birthday, borrowed his car, put it in the driveway, and presented it to her. And when she found out that it was all a tease, she was not a happy camper. But he does jokes like that. He's a jokester that way.
Rita has dedicated her life to serving others. That has been manifest through her diligent temple service and the four missions she served with Dick.
We started serving when Kimberly, our youngest, graduated, and that was in 1999. So we have been serving one day a week since 1999, except for our four mission. And two of those we served one night a week at the temple. So that's pretty unique and pretty amazing. For me, I just, something I love and would never want to lose. The highlight of my life, that's what I would say, next to family. And we were serving at the Boise Temple. We were planning on a mission or missions because I was still working 2 days a week. Dick still had a practice. We thought in a year we'll retire and go on a mission. We were at the temple serving, and Becky and Steve Smith had been called as mission president. So he and Becky grabbed us one night when they were there with all of their children. This was like just before they were going to leave to go. And Steve talked to Dick and Becky talked to me. In essence, they said, we'd like to have you come and serve a mission while we're there. This was like in October of 2004. And we said, we plan on going in about a year. And Steve said to Dick, no, we mean now, and we mean Russia. We want you to come. When he'd been called, they had been told that they needed to have senior couples come with him because they were only in 7 cities in the mission, and they needed a senior couple in every city. The mission is wider than the United States geographically and deeper than 2 United States sitting on top of each other, and they're only in 7 cities. So they needed to recruit 7 couples, and so that's what they were doing, was recruiting us. And so we said, okay, let us think about it for a day. Let us absorb this invitation. And as we talked about it, we thought, well, mission calls can come in more ways than one. Why can't we quit? Why do we have to wait till next year? So we told them we'd accept it. And so on January 21st, 2005, my birthday, we went into the MPC. Then we went to Russia for 18 months. And what a shocker. It was awesome in so many ways. And so weird in other ways. I mean, just a whole new way of life. It really made us appreciate America and what we have here and what we take for granted. It was new lifestyle, not just because it was a mission, but because it was in Russia. So we came back from that in August, and 4 months later, we went to Temple Square. So we went from the biggest mission to the smallest mission, because Temple Square is only 18 acres, I think. And we were there 3 months, and Dick was called to be one of the counselors in the mission presidency. That pulled me into the office also. And so we were no longer out on the square teaching and being involved, but we were involved in making the assignments to do all of that. And so we learned a whole different way of serving the Lord and meeting the needs and meeting people from all over the world. And it was quite the experience. And then we decided to go, Dick wanted to go to Tonga and do dentistry. We headed over there, and we weren't there very long before the habit of having little tiny 5 and 6-year-olds come in with nothing but black stubs in their mouth because their teeth had rotted out, literally. Just broke our hearts, and he couldn't live with that. And I couldn't either, but I didn't know what to do. He did. He started getting inspiration, and he put together a program in which we could teach the people. It was just lack of education, because the moms were putting soda pop and sweet drinks into the baby's bottles and feeding it to them. And so Dick put together this program, and we told the area presidency that we needed some money to put a video together. They said, yeah, we can do that in a couple of years. And they said, no, we need it now. We need it now. But they just couldn't work it into their budget. So he went about putting this together. And then we had another dentist come in and visit. And because there was another dentist to hold the clinic down, Dick said, well, we ought to just take a weekend off. So we went away to this little island, and we were only going to be there 2 or 3 days. And the little planes that get you there and back, the company shut down all of their planes. And so we were stranded on a South Pacific tropical island for 9 days, and our kids had no sympathy for us. We finally get back. Our home had been broken into and lived in for that week, and they trashed everything. They had consumed everything. All the food was gone. The money was gone. Everything was just bad. We were really hurt by it. Dick was ready to pick up and go home. But we slept on it a couple of nights, and pretty soon the South Pacific area president called and said, what can we do to help? And Dick said, I need a video. Forget the house. I need a video. And he said, all right, we'll find the money. If you can find somebody to do it, we'll provide the money. So we hung up the phone and called his cousin, who at the time was the head of the audiovisual department of the whole church in Salt Lake City. By the time we were ready to go in 2 or 3 weeks, he had spent over a week on the island with us, and Dick had been able to go out and help him get shots of things that he felt like he wanted in the video, and they had worked on the script together. We came back home, the video was put together, and they called him to come down and present it to the humanitarian and the welfare department at the church. I don't remember for sure, but I think it must have been about a month or two. We get a call from Salt Lake, and they say, if we call you back on another mission, will you take your program and implement it in Tonga? Well, that a dream request for him. And we said yes. So we went back and in 4 months taught over 14,000 people about what was going on their island with this terrible decay. And it was done beautifully through his inspiration. He knew we had to do it through the church structure. And that's what we did. We requested somebody on the island that spoke perfect English, who was Tongan. When we got on the island, we were introduced to a young woman. She was perfect for what we needed. And she organized everything for us. And we would go in and teach the stake leaders. And we had a bishop that was from the very end of the island come to us afterwards, just sobbing. This great big Tongan man, probably weighed 300 pounds. I mean, it was huge. And he was just sobbing like a baby. And he told us through his tears and his broken language, says, I have a daughter who has teeth like this, and I've never known why. And he was crying so hard because he was now feeling the responsibility. He realized that it was what they had done that had caused this. And so we spent a lot of time talking with him and helping him understand that you didn't know any better. Now you have the education. Now you have the opportunity to not only teach your family, but to teach your branch, to teach a ward, to teach your neighbors, teach everybody. So now you can go forward and do what is better for all of you. So that was quite miraculous. It was so well organized, we were done in about 4 months. The government of the island saw what we were doing, and they could not understand how we could get so many people to come together on such short notice and for dental information. And then they said, well, will you teach it in our schools? And so that opened up the whole island. And so we then got to go into every school, and these young people would come in and they'd either do it in the building or outside, and they would sit cross-legged on the floor or outside on the grass, and the palm trees were swaying back and forth and water waves are flashing up over here. And we have 400 kids. And so we were able to teach in every school that way. We just look back on it and say, what an opportunity. Those are extremely rewarding years that we've had.
Those missions, along with countless experiences throughout her life, have solidified Rita's testimony in the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Without my family, there would be no reason to be here. The Lord's purpose is beautiful and it's perfect. And all we have to do is us imperfect people plug into it and do the best we can. Our family brings us total joy. Yes, there's heartaches. Yes, there's challenges, but they bring us our joy and our happiness always. Nothing is better than to just have them all around you and be able to laugh together or whatever. As far as I'm concerned, the Lord's plan, our purpose for being here, is made so clear through the gospel. When you hear it and you feel it, it hits you in the heart. How can you say no to it? How can you say anything but thank you, Heavenly Father? Thank you. And then to have your children accept it and see them turn around and do the same thing with their children, your grandchildren. That's where our joy comes from now, is watching them.
As you've heard, Rita has dedicated her life to the people around her. She lovingly cared for her patients, those she served in the mission field, her family, and her sweetheart Dick for the last 60 years. She's lived her life as a true disciple of Jesus Christ. A huge thank you to Nicole Rasmussen and the Euler children for making this episode possible. And thank you to the Euler's for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.